from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In this segment of Forum, we're going to take a look at some research that was recently published in an issue of Current Biology, research by UC Berkeley scientists, a team led by Professors Shinji Nishimoto and Jack Gallant, showing how looking at brain activity can provide, with the help of new technology, specifically a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, a fairly good picture of human visual experience. Will science open the portals to seeing inside of our minds? Well, we're going to talk about this newly published research in this Forum segment, and we are joined by Jack Gallant in studio, professor of psychology and neuroscience programs in bioengineering, biophysics, and vision science at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here.
Well, where to begin with this? Begin maybe with what it is, and then let's talk about what it has been made out in the media. I mean, you would think by reading some of these stories that Inception is right around the corner, or the for those who saw the movie Inception, but we're talking about decades away from really allowing us to read other thoughts or memories and that sort of thing. And this could be, as we'll discuss, a wonderful tool. But let's find out what you did. I mean, what you set up and everything, because it has a lot to do with blood, perhaps, and rather than neurons, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does have to do with blood. In fact, only blood. The experiment used an MRI machine. And a functional MRI measures changes in blood flow and blood oxygen use that occur after neural activity in the brain. So MRI is a very indirect measure of what the brain is doing, and it's very low resolution. The MRI machine measures at a spatial resolution about the size of a pea, and there might be a half a million or a million neurons inside that space. So MRI gives you a sort of a pale shadow of what's going on in the brain. And because it's measuring blood flow, which is really the plumbing of the brain rather than the neurons, it's much slower than brain activity.
This is all in the cortical part of the brain, basically, isn't it?
That's what we focused on. You can measure, you know, any part of the brain with fMRI, but in this particular study, we focused only on cortex because we were interested in early visual processing, and most of vision in mammals occurs in the cortex.
But this is a whole basis for decoding the brain. I mean, that's essentially the thought here, isn't it?
This is kind of a weird thought, but actually decoding is just a sideline for us. It's not our main focus. We're a basic neuroscience lab, and we want to understand how the brain works. And to do that, you need to build an encoding model, a model that allows you to go from the world to brain activity. But once you have an encoding model that describes how the brain encodes information in the world, then it's actually pretty mathematically trivial to just turn it into a decoder. So anything you sort of learn about the brain that allows you to model it as an encoding model, you can then use to decode brain activity at the same resolution.
This is also, we should put this into lay terms, about what are called BOLD signals, and I don't mean signals that are based on boldness from the brain, blood oxygen level dependence.
Right, but the BOLD signals are what the MRI machine measures. It's kind of strange to think about, but for most people who use MRI, say doctors at a hospital looking at anatomy, blood flow is actually a problem. It's a bug, not a feature, because they try to get rid of it because it contaminates their images. But if you're interested in brain activity, then blood flow is the major thing that you try to optimize and you try to look for because of these changes in blood flow that are associated loosely with changes in the underlying neural activity.
Talking with a researcher and professor of psychology and neuroscience programs in bioengineering, biophysics, and vision science, Jack Gallant, who's here with us in studio. Individual brains are so much different, though. I mean, the images in the brains are completely individual, aren't they?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Brains differ as much as any of the rest of the parts of your body differ from one person to another. So the size of brains differs a lot. The large folds will be similar in different people's brains, but they'll be a lot of subtle differences. And the size of individual parts of the brain varies. So primary visual cortex is the largest single area of your brain, and it varies by 200% across people. So if you want to either build models of people's brains or do brain decoding, you're actually going to do best if you build a model for each individual person. And if you average over people, you lose a lot of information.
In fact, I saw, talk about variation, I saw the two pictures, the actual picture and then the pretty dramatic difference between the two in a lot of ways now at this point, one could say, no?
I take it you're talking about the picture that we showed the person in the magnet and then the decoded picture.
Exactly.
A lot of that has to do with the brain algorithm.
Decoded picture looks pretty murky compared to the other picture.
Right, you know, right.
Like a pastiche or something, yeah.
It's exactly like a pastiche, actually. The one nice analogy is you can think of it that we're measuring brain activity and we're using the model we have of the brain to try to paint a picture or to try to paint a movie, really, of what the person saw in the magnet. But our palette, instead of containing paint, contains other movies. So we have to try to reconstruct the movie that the person saw using a set of movies that they didn't see, and that's never going to be perfect. But we can do an amazingly good job considering we were doing this entirely based on brain activity and on the models we had of the brain, and that these models were derived from bold signals and not neurons.
And how many millions of seconds are we talking about of movies or YouTubes? Or?
Well, to build the model inside the MRI machine, we had the subjects, which in this case were several of our co-authors, lie down in the magnet for about 3 hours over a couple of weeks, and they just watched Hollywood movie trailers. And they didn't have to do any task. And then we used those data to actually build a model that described how simple features in the movies, like little oriented edges and patches of texture and motion in the movies, how those were related to activity at different points in the brain. And in this experiment, we measured about 4,000 different points in the brain.
So this is really potentially very exciting. I mean, despite all the hype, and there has been a lot of hype, we could understand many of the mysterious parts of the brain eventually through this kind of imaging, can't we?
Yeah, a really good way to think about understanding the brain is that essentially you want to build a dictionary that translates between the world to the brain. And the brain consists of, nobody's quite sure, but probably something around 200 to 500 different parts. So you're going to have something like 200 to 500 different dictionaries that describe the relationship between the world and the brain separately for each part. And really the goal of our lab is to build a dictionary for each part of the visual system. In humans, the vision is about a third of your brain. So we're talking about maybe 75 different dictionaries that are going to have to be built. And in this study, we only built one dictionary for the very earliest, simplest part of the brain.
Well, let's not get expectations too inflated or high here. I mean, two words come to mind, artificial intelligence, when it comes to those kinds of expectations. But I'm going to open up the phone lines and invite listeners to join us. And you can do that now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. If you have questions for Jack Gallant or comments about this brave new world, as I've been calling it, our phone line is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, and you can join the conversation. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, email address forum@kqed.org. Or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or simply putting your ideas or thoughts or questions or comments. We can't see into your mind, but you can put them on our Facebook page just by visiting facebook.com/kqedforum. I'm also struck by just what a wonderful tool this could be. And again, one doesn't want to get too caught up in inflating the possibilities here, but students, for example, patients who can't verbalize, who are in a coma or a stroke or something like that. You know, my mother was in the longest period in a kind of coma, and we didn't know if she could hear us or if she could communicate. She couldn't communicate, but we didn't know if she was actually taking in what we were saying. But if you're reading thoughts, you can indeed communicate, potentially.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the first potential applications of this technology, because right now the only way to do decent sort of brain decoding or brain reading is with an MRI machine. There's no other technology that can measure the brain with this high resolution necessary to do a good job of decoding. But an MRI machine is really large, and you have to sort of lie in it, and it costs millions of dollars. It's not a portable technology. So the first use of this kind of technology is going to be in a hospital setting to solve a medical problem. And I think it would be fantastic to try to apply this technology to not only stroke victims, but also victims of neurodegenerative diseases who become locked in and can't communicate. And using the current technology, they would have to try to learn to communicate with visual images, but presumably at some time later, you could decode other kinds of thought or internal speech and have them communicate directly.
Not only decode, but couldn't you theoretically recreate dreams and memories with this new brain imaging technology?
In theory, you could, but the question is how well that's going to work in practice. So think of it this way. You know, there must be something different in your brain when you're wandering around the world doing visual perception and when you're dreaming. Because if your brain was exactly the same in those two cases, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So the brain is going to operate differently when you're dreaming or doing visual imagery than when you're walking around the world. And we've built a model that describes how normal visual perception works. We just don't know at this stage how well this model is going to work to describe dreams and visual imagery.
But you got your own dictionary, just like Dr. Johnson, right? I mean, that's your
every person will have their own dictionary. Yeah.
Yeah. And theoretically, it could be, again, just talking theoretically, and again, I don't want to get too much into the hype here, but applications to creativity and artistic production, those kinds of things?
Oh, we've thought about those things. There's no reason you couldn't use this to do brain-aided painting or brain-aided CAD-CAM. If you built one of these encoding-decoding dictionaries for music, or for you could have somebody compose music in the magnet. I think there's a lot of those kinds of applications.
Good way to publicize the fact that in the next hour we're going to be talking about the 100th anniversary of the San Francisco Symphony, and we'll be focusing on music and hearing some of the symphony's music. In the meantime, you can join us in this conversation with Jack Gallant. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. From Berkeley, Ping, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Just a moment ago, you were talking about one of the first applications of this technology being communicating with people who can't otherwise communicate. And in the study, or in the paper, and in the video online, you're looking at the image that's been reconstructed right next to the image that the person was actually watching. So it's very easy to convince yourself that they look the same. Like priming the observer, an experiment, you're inclined to think that you're right. But if you were only to look at the image that was reconstructed, how would you have any confidence that that was actually what you thought you were seeing was what that person was actually thinking about?
Good question.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And this is one of the challenges to doing any kind of brain decoding when you don't have ground truth, right? In the basic experiment here, we knew what we showed the subjects, so we could quantify exactly how well we were decoding. But if you were working with patients who couldn't communicate, or if you were trying to decode dreams, you would have no ground truth, and it would be very difficult to verify. So I think at this stage, this technology probably isn't ready for this. But there are several clear limitations to the technology that I think we can overcome. There are three factors that limit how well we can decode information from the brain. One is how you measure brain activity. The second is how good your models of the brain are. And the third is how big your computers are. And buying bigger computers is fairly easy. Building better models of the brain, you know, models improve all the time. So this technology is going to improve in the future. It's going to get better and better. And I think at some point it will become clear that it can be applied to patients. And I just don't really know exactly how long that will take.
But this is a pretty small subset of what people saw or understood, was it not, in terms of your research?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your
question. Very small subset in terms of what you were able to work with. And, I mean, you were talking about one individual dictionary and so forth, but you got out of all those millions of...
So the video online is only 30 seconds, and we're really only reconstructing about 10 minutes of data here,
because
that was the data we had in the data set that we were trying to model. I think one of the things that's kind of lost in the current video that's online is that we're only decoding the earliest stages of the visual system here. There are 75 different visual areas, and you could build a dictionary for each one, and you could aggregate those dictionaries together to get much better decoding. At this stage, we haven't done that because this is sort of the first step to decoding dynamic brain activity. But I think the reconstructions will get better very, very fast once we're using multiple dictionaries rather than just one dictionary.
Well, can you talk about what kind of decoding models are needed for translation of specific brain activity?
Sure. The visual system is sort of organized hierarchically. Information comes in to primary visual cortex, and primary visual cortex is concerned with little simple features like where edges are and where they're moving in the scene and simple texture patterns and things like that. But that part of the brain doesn't know anything about the objects that are in a scene or the shapes or whether something's your grandmother. Much later, the higher levels of visual system encodes the semantic information in the scene. Is this your dog? Is it a cat? Is there somebody walking across the scene? Is there a plane flying over? And those parts of the brain don't know so much about the specific features that are going to construct the object, but they know about the nature of the objects. So you can imagine if we combined a decoder, a dictionary that decoded the early visual system and a dictionary that decoded the higher visual system, and we required that those decoded results be consistent, then we're going to get a lot better results of decoding.
And you've said that this technology is constantly in a process of advancing. You know?
Always. In fact, since there's a simple mathematical relationship between building a good encoding model and being able to do decoding, it basically tells you that anything neuroscientists learn about the way the brain works will help them do better decoding.
But there's no real sense of a timeline here. I mean, it's just a hazarding a guess. You're shrugging your shoulders. I mean, that's where we are, right?
Yeah. These kinds of technologies are, you know, kind of out there at the edge of what science can do. And so no one really knows how long it's going to take to build decoding devices that, you know, that both appear to be decoding a lot of activity and that you have any kind of confidence in.
What's the response you've been getting, say, from the medical community, particularly from those who deal with people who are stroke victims, for example?
Well, I think it's...
Are they pretty excited by it?
I think people are excited about it, but everyone is sort of waiting at this stage. I mean, this is a basic science finding, and I think an application requires a more engineering approach where you really try to optimize the decoding. And to be honest, we didn't try to optimize the decoding in this case.
Why not?
Because it's kind of not our job. So what we did is we built a decoder that simply demonstrated, look, you can decode. But for example, we didn't try to de-blur the images. So for example, if you're trying to decode a face, you showed someone a face and a person talking, and you try to decode the face. And in this particular experiment, we searched through a library of 18 million images, and we find the 100 movies that we predict are most like the movie you saw, and then we simply average them together. And a lot of those will be faces, and you'll get kind of a blurry face-like blob out of the decoder. But if you really wanted to do a good job, what you would do is you would introduce a computer vision algorithm at that stage that would align the eyes and the mouth so that things would be less blurry and you'd get a better result.
You were using some YouTube stuff too, weren't you, mainly?
The movies that we showed subjects in the magnet were actually Hollywood movie trailers. And the reason we use those is, you know, people have to watch these things for 3 hours, and it's kind of a boring experiment. So we figured if we used Hollywood movie trailers, they'd be more excited and engaged, because that's the point of Hollywood movie trailers. But to do decoding, we actually used a giant library of 18 million seconds of YouTube video that we downloaded at random from the internet. So the movies we used for our palette to do the reconstructions were completely independent of the movies we showed subjects in the magnet.
And how many subjects did you work with, and over what kind of period of time?
Well, this was 3 subjects, and they were actually co-authors. And the development of this experiment probably took dozens of hours of time in the magnet, but the data that actually goes into the paper is only a few hours.
And again, we're talking with Jack Gallant, and he's professor of psychology, neuroscience programs in bioengineering, biophysics, and vision science at the University of California, Berkeley. And let me go to Scott, who's joining us from Stanford. Scott, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if I could ask a quick question about the anatomical comments that the doctor was making. He referred to the variations between individuals in their soft tissue architecture in the brain, and I wondered if you also have to correct for differences in the vascular tree. I'm aware that the major arteries between individuals in the cerebrovascular system have significant variations, and I wondered if the blood vessels of interest for fMRI are also variable enough that you have to correct for differences.
That's a great question. Traditionally, when people try to align brains, you know, different individual brains sort of into the same coordinate system, the same space, they do it purely anatomically. And actually, that doesn't work all that well. You can make the brain sort of the same shape, but the problem is that the brain areas differ across people. And as you point out, the blood supply differs across people. And of course, MRI is actually measuring the blood supply, not the neurons. So to try to improve alignment across individuals has been a difficult challenge. And recently, Professor Jim Haxby at Dartmouth developed this, his lab developed a really great method for doing functional alignment of brains. And their method actually is simply to have people lie in the magnet and they watch movies. And then they ignore the anatomical data almost entirely and try to map the brains into one another so that the functional responses of the brains are as similar as possible across people. And that turns out to work really well.
And I thank the caller. And let me go to some of your emails. Dave in San Mateo says, why did you use videos from YouTube as a training set? They are likely not very random, since most videos will use cinematic shots like a face close-up or an item moving in the vertical center from left to right. Did you try using computer-generated randomized imagery? And do you think your results look overly optimistic due to the repetitive nature of YouTube clips?
Oh, that's actually 2 good questions. The first is, why do we use YouTube rather than just some computer-generated stuff? And the answer is, it was easy. I mean, YouTube has a lot of video. Billions of videos are on YouTube, so it's fairly easy, although slow, to download a large video library. So that was simply the quickest way we could download a video
library.
Much
more efficient, yeah.
Yeah, it was the quickest way we could make a video library that was independent of the movies that we showed. However, the writer is completely correct. All videos that you find online are biased. They're biased by the videographer. The videographer is trying to tell a story. And when people tell stories in video, they tend to use certain motifs that repeat. They tend to show the same things over and over again. They tend to show them from the same point of view. And that's actually true both for the Hollywood movie trailers and for the YouTube videos. So in fact, The caller's correct. The statistics of the YouTube videos actually helped us improve our reconstructions of the Hollywood videos. And you can view that as a feature or a bug. In this case, we view that as a good thing because we're exploiting the statistics of the videos to try to recover extra signal that compensates for the fact that the brain activity measurements are actually fairly poor.
Ray, go ahead. Join us. You're on. Hi.
Yes, hi. I'm curious whether it's been looked at when people are telling the truth versus lying, different parts of the brain are activated and something could be done with this. Also, can you identify, you know, personality type if somebody's more visual, more oral or aural? And, you know, what personality type corresponds to flow patterns and activation patterns in the brain?
Actually, you know Paul Ekman's work, of course, I'm sure.
Yes.
A psychology professor, colleague of yours. He's done a lot with faces and
yes.
Telling the truth and so forth. But we've got seconds left.
But I think the caller was asking about MRI. Yes,
MRI and truth-telling. Yeah.
Right. People have worked on MRI lie detection. It hasn't worked very well yet. I think it has the same exact problems that polygraphs have in that the measurements are fundamentally unreliable and people's memories are very unreliable. And that complicates any effort to use either the polygraph or MRI to do lie detection.
Back to a few more emails here. Deepak says, why was a series of videos used for the color palette? Wouldn't just a video of moving shapes and different colors do a better job? Maybe I'm oversimplifying, but the question is out there.
Possibly, right? We used videos in this case for a kind of a weird reason that I'll try to explain. Remember that the brain activity measurements are only taken once a second because it just takes a second for the magnet to measure the entire brain. So you're sampling the brain activity fairly, fairly slowly, much slower than the rate of the videos. So if you want to reconstruct a video, you can't do it frame by frame. You essentially have to reconstruct this little cube of space-time, this little one-second spatiotemporal event in the movie. And it turns out to do that, it's much better to just use natural movies because they already have the right statistical characteristics of the things you're trying to reconstruct. Now, you can imagine if we were trying to decode someone's dreams, we might need to use something more abstract or some computer algorithm to generate bizarre shapes or bizarre conjunctions of things that you would never find on YouTube. And that's kind of an open area of research for the future.
Another listener, Marcia in Sacramento, says, sorry, Michael, I just came in on this. Was there any mention of the kinds of radiation exposure while being in this technology? No, there wasn't. You want to address that?
I'll address that. As far as anyone knows, MRI is completely safe. MRI is magnetic imaging, and essentially it's a large stationary magnet that aligns a small fraction of the protons in your body along the main magnetic field. And as far as anyone knows and as far as any scientific information tells us, this is basically an innocuous process.
And then we go to Sergey. Join us. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning. Sergey? Well, we'll try one more time. Sergey, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, please, speak to us.
Yes, the question is, in order to decode anything, you need to go to the lowest information level. And in this case, the question is there any common protocol between different parts of the brain that could be decoded? And the second question is it possible to simulate the electrical activity of the brain outside of the brain? So by mimicking basically this protocol.
Those are two great questions. The first is, if we had measured sort of a more low-level activity in the brain, would we be able to do better decoding? And in fact, that's true. I mean, neurons communicate with one another by these little sort of punctate events called action potentials. And if you could record from all the neurons in the brain and record all of the action potentials, then presumably you could figure out what the neural code is,
Jack, what's a punctate event?
It's a little discrete event, I mean. An action potential takes about a millisecond, and a neuron fires an action potential, and those action potentials are what neurons use to communicate with one another. So it's kind of like a Morse code for the brain. So if you could measure a large number of neurons, and you could measure these action potentials and infer what the Morse code is, then you would be able to do a great job of decoding. But that kind of technology is just not practical. You can't record from a large number of neurons in humans unless they're undergoing a procedure preparing them for some sort of brain surgery. The second question...
It's about electronic stimulation.
The second question was about stimulation. Yeah, this comes up all the time. It's really not obvious. It's not intuitively obvious, but it's kind of interesting that decoding is much, much easier than inserting information into the brain. To decode, all we have to do is measure a certain point in the brain and find a systematic relationship between the world and the things that are happening at that point in the brain. But to put information into the brain doesn't require just stimulating a location. It requires stimulating it in a systematic way that's closely related to the lowest level of information flow, again, these action potentials. And if all we do is just put in some noise into a location in the brain, it's kind of like hitting somebody in the head with a hammer. So people have done experiments using transcranial magnetic stimulation to stimulate specific parts of the brain, but that's really a method for knocking out a part of the brain. It's not really a method for putting information in.
So where do you go in your research from here?
Well, we're a visual neuroscience lab, and as I said earlier, there are something on the order of 50, 75, 100 visual areas, and we only have a really good model of two of them right now. So our goal is to try to build more models of all of more of the visual areas because we're trying to understand how you see.
And pretty hopeful, despite, like I say, all the hype and all the attention that this has gotten that may be overboard?
Well, you know, the decoding is always popular, right? If I was just publishing papers about here's how the brain works, no one would care. But if you put a decoding aspect onto it, everybody's interested in decoding. But I'm optimistic because we're making steady progress. And, you know, the wonderful thing about MRI is even though it doesn't measure neurons, it's a marvelous technology that changes all the time. You never know what new kinds of brain activity measurements are going to come out next week.
Well, one final question from John in Oakland. Are we going to be able to get movies sent directly into our brains without going to the multiplex?
Unfortunately, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, no. Depositing movies into your brains is going to be, you know, a long ways away, long after our lifetimes. However, we might be able to decode the movies from your brain that play internally that other people can't see, and then you could show those to your friends.
We're a long way from Leonardo DiCaprio and Inception, as I said at the beginning, but it's fascinating stuff. And Jack Allen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you,
sharing.
Sir.
Jack Allen, again, is professor of psychology and neuroscience programs in bioengineering, biophysics, and vision science at the University of California, Berkeley. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of forum coming up, and we're going to talk in that hour all about the San Francisco Symphony celebrating its centennial this year. Executive director and the musical director and one of the cellists will be joining us in studio. I hope you'll join us as well. We'll hear some symphonic music. Want to give thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Paul Ancour, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling 415-553-3300, or joining us on our Facebook page just by visiting facebook.com/kqedforum. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.